I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
The Trump administration, led by Marco Rubio, Secretary of State, is really making a play for Latin America. Venezuela, sure, there's oil, and that's important, but there's a lot of ways to get oil. But what's really at stake is getting Latin America organized, like moving on from Venezuela. You see Venezuela as the first step into a larger restructuring of the politics of the hemisphere. Venezuela will be first, and then Cuba, and then Nicaragua, and then isolating Brazil and Mexico.
As President Trump orders a complete blockade of sanctioned oil tankers coming and going from Venezuela, we'll speak to the Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Greg Grandin. He says Trump's dated strategy is putting us on a path to World War III. Then Chile's elected its most right-wing president since Augusto Pinochet.
We will tirelessly work to recover calm, order, growth, and hope, because Chile has demanded something that doesn't allow excuses. Chile wants a change.
We'll look at the election of far-right politician Jose Antonio Kast with the renowned Chilean writer Ariel Dorfman. He calls the election a political and ethical earthquake. We'll speak to him in Santiago. Plus, how did Jeffrey Epstein become rich?
How did Jeffrey Epstein have the financial backing to abuse what turns out to be hundreds of young women and girls through months of reporting and digging through documents?
People's diaries, letters, old photo albums.
The answer is he stole it.
We'll speak to New York Times reporter David Enrich about his new piece, Scams, Schemes, Ruthless Cons, the untold story of how Jeffrey Epstein got rich. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Trump ordered a blockade on sanctioned oil tankers going to and from Venezuela Tuesday, ramping up his threats on President Nicolas Maduro. In a post on social media, Trump said, quote, Venezuela's completely surrounded by the largest armada ever assembled in the history of South America. It will only get bigger, and the shock to them will be like nothing they have ever seen before, unquote. Last week, the U.S. seized a tanker in the Caribbean Sea that was carrying Venezuelan oil for Cuba and China. Since September, the U.S. military has been carrying out airstrikes on alleged drug boats in the Caribbean and Eastern Pacific near Venezuela, killing at least 95 people in 25 attacks without showing evidence of drugs. Meanwhile, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth said Tuesday there are no plans to release the full unedited video showing a deadly second strike on a boat on September 2nd. Legal experts and human rights groups have described the strike on two survivors clinging to the wreckage of the boat as a war crime. This comes as Trump's chief of staff, Susie Wiles, suggested in an interview with Vanity Fair that the U.S. military attacks on alleged drug boats aim to ultimately topple President Maduro. Wiles said, quote, Trump wants to keep on blowing boats up until Maduro cries uncle. And people way smarter than me on that say that he will, unquote. This is Maduro speaking yesterday in Caracas.
We tell the people of the United States our truth, and it is very clear. Imperialism and the Nazi fascist right wing want to colonize Venezuela to take our wealth, oil, gas, gold, iron, aluminum, and other minerals. We have sworn to defend our homeland, and in Venezuela, peace will always prevail, along with stability and shared happiness for our people.
President Trump is planning to give a primetime address to the nation tonight. We'll have more on this story later in the broadcast. In Gaza, Al Jazeera reports a two-week-old infant has frozen to death as winter storms batter the territory, and Israel continues to block the entry of shelter and other humanitarian supplies for the hundreds of thousands of displaced Palestinians forced to live in makeshift tents or buildings damaged by Israeli bombs. Meanwhile, in another violation of the U.S. brokered truce, Al Jazeera reports Israeli forces killed at least one Palestinian in the last 24 hours. This comes as efforts to recover the remains of the last Israeli hostage in Gaza have been hampered by the heavy rains. The International Criminal Court has rejected Israel's bid to block an investigation into war crimes committed by Israel in Gaza. In more related news, Axios reports the White House sent an angry private message to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu following the killing of Hamas senior commander Raed Saad, which Trump officials said violated the U.S. brokered ceasefire that went into effect in October. Netanyahu is scheduled to meet Trump at Mar-a-Lago at the end of the month as tensions rise around the implementation of the next phase of the agreement with Hamas. In Sydney, Australia, the first funerals were held today for victims of the Bondi Beach massacre, including for Rabbi Eli Schlanger and Rabbi Yaakov Levitan. Meanwhile, authorities announced one of the gunmen, 24-year-old Navid Akram, has been charged with 59 offenses, including murder and terrorism. The other gunman, his father, Sajid Akram, was shot dead by police at the scene. Here in the United States, in Rhode Island, the manhunt for the gunman who killed two students and injured nine others at Brown University Saturday has entered its fifth day. Authorities released a new photo, enhanced videos, and a video timeline showing a person of interest movements in the hours leading up to Saturday's shooting. One shooting victim remains in critical condition. Two have been discharged from the hospital. Six others are in stable condition. All classes and exams have been canceled. The campus remains on edge. This is Parth Gupta, a senior at Brown.
Brown was honestly one of the happiest IVs. That's how it was always known. But now, after everything that's happened, it's kind of become extremely scary. As a senior, having seen 3 years at Brown, like, I don't even know how this incident is going to change campus. It's very scary to go back, and it's extremely unfortunate to see what happened to a place like Brown.
An MIT professor was fatally shot at his home in Brookline, Massachusetts. Authorities have opened a homicide investigation into the killing of 47-year-old Nuno Loureiro, who was the director of MIT's Plasma Science and Fusion Center. In January, President Biden had awarded the Presidential Early Career Award for scientists and engineers to Professor Loureiro. In an explosive set of articles in Vanity Fair, journalist Christopher Whipple, author of a book on chiefs of staff, conducted 11 interviews with President Trump's chief of staff, Susie Wiles, over the course of a year. Wiles characterized President Trump as having an alcoholic's personality and said she urged him not to pardon the most violent rioters from the January 6th insurrection. In the interview, she says she thought Trump's efforts to go after his political enemies would end after 90 days and mentioned his campaign against New York Attorney General Letitia James, quote, may look like retribution. Wiles also said Vice President J.D. Vance has, quote, been a conspiracy theorist for a decade and called Russell Vogt, the budget director, a right-wing absolute zealot. She also called Elon Musk an avowed ketamine user and blasted his dismantling of USAID, saying, quote, no rational person could think the USAID process was a good one. Nobody, she said. On immigration, Susie Wiles said, quote, I will concede we've got to look harder at our process for deportation, unquote. Wiles also criticized Attorney General Pam Bondi's handling of the Epstein files, saying, quote, she said that the witness list or client list was on her desk. There is no client list, and it sure as hell wasn't on her desk, unquote. Meanwhile, the deadline for the Justice Department to release the Epstein files is set for Friday, December 19th. House Speaker Mike Johnson says he will not call for a vote to extend Affordable Care Act health care subsidies that are set to expire at the end of the year. As a result, millions of U.S. residents will have to pay higher health insurance premiums starting in January. Republican Congressmember Mike Lawler of New York said, quote, everybody has a responsibility to serve their district to their constituents. You know what is funny? Three quarters of people on Obamacare are in states Donald Trump won, Lawler said. Some House Republicans have signaled they would join Democrats in passing a discharge petition to force a House vote on a clean three-year extension of the subsidies, but that's unlikely to get a floor vote until next year. President Trump signed an order expanding his travel ban into the U.S. with partial or full restrictions to nationals from at least 20 additional countries, including Burkina Faso, Mali, Niger, South Sudan, and Syria. The Trump administration's also fully restricted travel into the U.S. for people holding Palestinian Authority travel documents. In related news, the New York Times reports the Trump administration's transferred 22 Cuban immigrants to the Guantanamo Bay U.S. Naval Base in Cuba. The men are believed to be the first Cuban citizens to be sent to Guantanamo since Trump returned to office and began his mass deportation campaign. It's estimated ICE has detained over 700 immigrants at Guantanamo this year. In news from Sudan, the UAE-backed paramilitary Rapid Support Forces has been attempting to cover up its mass killings of civilians in the city of El Fasher by burning and burying bodies. That's according to a new report by Yale's Humanitarian Research Lab, which analyzed satellite images depicting RSF fighters likely disposing of tens of thousands of remains following its capture of El Fasher, the capital of North Darfur, in October. At least 1,500 people were killed in just 48 hours after the RSF seized the city. The report said, quote, this pattern of body disposal and destruction is ongoing, unquote. This comes as over 100 civilians were killed in drone attacks on the Kordofan region, where fighting between the RSF and Sudanese military is intensified. Tens of thousands of people have been displaced as warring parties shift focus toward Kordofan. UN experts describe Sudan's war as the world's largest humanitarian disaster. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, M23 leaders say they've agreed to withdraw from the key town of Uvira in the eastern DRC at the request of the Trump administration. This comes just days after Secretary of State Marco Rubio condemned the city's capture last week, saying it violated a U.S. brokered truce signed by Rwandan President Paul Kagame and DRC leader Felix Tshisekedi earlier this month at a ceremony in Washington, D.C., hosted by Trump. M23 fighters are not signatories of that deal and have been involved in parallel peace talks led by Qatar. Rwanda has been repeatedly accused of backing M23. In related news, Human Rights Watch reports at least 22 civilians were killed and scores more injured in an attack by militia fighters in late November on a territory in the western DRC. As ethnic conflicts rise in the region, HRW said in a statement, quote, the global focus on the peace accords in eastern Congo shouldn't distract from the unchecked violence and injustice and the cycles of impunity in other areas. In India, authorities are mandating all private and government employers to direct staff to work from home, and schools have canceled in-person classes as dense, toxic smog has engulfed New Delhi, pushing dangerous pollution levels to a record high. Healthcare officials have advised residents to avoid all outdoor activities and to wear a mask, as hospitals have reported a rising number of people suffering from breathing conditions and eye irritation. The toxic haze has also affected visibility, impacting travel with dozens of flights and trains delayed. This is a tourist who is stranded in New Delhi.
Visibility is very low. I can't see anything. We reached here by car yesterday due to fog and pollution. We could not see anything. We came to India Gate, but we can't see it. We can hardly see it as we have come closer. Pollution is also affecting my health a lot.
Greece's parliament approved a new budget Tuesday as massive protests were held by farmers and public sector workers denouncing low wages and skyrocketing food and housing costs. Earlier on Tuesday, protesters gathered in Athens.
We are striking today across the entire public sector and coordinating with the struggle waged by farmers against the government's passage of this budget. It is a budget that cuts millions from public hospitals, where I also work, and channels the money into military spending. It hands it to the banks. We will not allow this.
And Warner Brothers Discovery is reportedly rejecting Paramount Skydance's $108 billion hostile takeover bid to acquire the company. On Tuesday, Affinity Partners, which is run by President Trump's son-in-law Jared Kushner, backed out of Paramount's deal. The move paves the way for Netflix to go ahead with its $83 billion bid for Warner Brothers. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
President Trump has ordered a total and complete blockade of sanctioned oil tankers entering and leaving Venezuela as the U.S. ramps up pressure on the government of Nicolas Maduro. The blockade comes amidst a major U.S. military buildup in the region and days after the U.S. seized an oil tanker filled with Venezuelan oil. In a post on Truth Social, Trump wrote, quote, Venezuela's completely surrounded by the largest armada ever assembled in the history of South America. It will only get bigger, and the shock to them will be like nothing they have ever seen before, unquote. Since September, the U.S. military has also carried out at least 25 airstrikes on alleged drug boats without offering evidence in the Caribbean and Eastern Pacific near Venezuela, killing at least 95 people. On Tuesday, Vanity Fair published excerpts of bombshell interviews with Trump's chief of staff, Susie Wiles, in which she suggested the aim of the boat strikes is to topple Maduro. Wiles said, quote, Trump wants to keep on blowing boats up until Maduro cries uncle and people way smarter than me on that say that he will, unquote. On Tuesday, President Maduro denounced the U.S. actions.
We tell the people of the United States our truth, and it is very clear. Imperialism and the Nazi fascist right wing want to colonize Venezuela to take our wealth, oil, gas, gold, iron, aluminum, and other minerals. We have sworn to defend our homeland, and in Venezuela, peace will always prevail, along with stability and shared happiness for our people. To the people of the United States, we say again and again, one and a thousand times.
No blood for oil. No war for oil. Eso del narcotráfico.
The claims about drug trafficking are fake news, a lie, an excuse. Since they cannot accuse us of weapons of mass destruction, chemical weapons, or nuclear missiles, they invent another pretext to create another Afghanistan, another Libya. And with moral authority and with God's blessing, I say,
no more Vietnam, no more Afghanistan, no more Libya, no more Iraq. No more war eternal. No, 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 no.
We know we are morally and spiritually in the right.
We're joined now by the Pulitzer Prize-winning historian, Yale University professor Greg Grandin. His latest book, America, America, A New History of the New World. He has a recent piece in the New York Times headlined, Trump's dated strategy is putting us on a path to World War III. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Professor Grandin. Can you start off by responding to what's happening right now? We are doing this broadcast before President Trump makes his address to the nation tonight. Unclear what that's about. But talk about the latest developments with Venezuela.
Well, it is an unprecedented military buildup. It's probably bigger than what the Spanish Empire sent to retake Spain in the 1820s in terms of sheer destruction. executive force, and the classification of fentanyl as a weapon of mass destruction, and all sorts of presidential announcements that, you know, trying to lay a legal justification for this. And of course, as this is going on, they're still blowing up speedboats in the Caribbean and the Pacific. And as you mentioned, Susan Wiles, the secretary, the chief of staff of Trump, said that this had nothing to do with narco-terrorism, that Trump actually doesn't really care about narco drugs coming into the country. This is really just setting up and hoping to induce a regime change in Venezuela. And Venezuela is really just the first step. Marco Rubio, the Secretary of State from Florida, from South Florida, whose family is not itself is not uninvolved in drug trafficking, sees it in very ideological terms. He's, you know, Cuban, and for whatever reason, they see Venezuela as the first step of finally bringing down the Cuban Revolution and bringing Cuba back into the orbit of the United States. And then from there, of course, it's Nicaragua. And we just saw this election in Chile, which I know you're going to talk about later with Ariel Dorfman. But Latin America really is on a kind of knife's edge between the left and the right. We see in Argentina, Javier Milei, and what the United States is willing to do to keep him in power, billions and billions of dollars, not just through the Treasury Department, but also through the IMF to prop up the peso. Honduras, there's all sorts of machinations going on there in terms of the election that the U.S. was involved in. And so that really leaves Latin America divided, almost unprecedentedly divided. In the past, Latin America tended to be coherent, and I tend to be all dictatorships or all kind of center-left presidents. And now we have a continent that's split angularly down the middle. And the image is quite stark. You have Brazil and you have Mexico, and those are the two bulwarks of Latin America. And ultimately, if you're going to get Latin America under control and back under the U.S.'s umbrella, you have to confront those two countries. Ultimately, that is the end goal. And this is in the larger context of a dramatic reversal of U.S. foreign policy, the total renunciation of liberal internationalism. Now, liberal internationalism as an ideal, there was a big gap between in practice and as it actually functioned. But the idea was that the United States would superintend a world governed by common laws. The Trump administration announced in its national security strategy document, which it put out last week or a couple of weeks ago, that the bipartisan consensus that came out of the Cold War has failed. And it had been essentially announced implicitly that what it sees as replacing it is a Monroe Doctrine for the entire world. The way the United States acted with impunity to seize, to kill, and to sanction, it could do anywhere.
Which brings us to what Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth just said at the Reagan Defense Forum. He said, quote, "The Monroe Doctrine is in effect.
After years of neglect, the United States will restore U.S. military dominance in the Western Hemisphere. We will use it to protect our homeland and access to key terrain throughout the region. We will also deny adversaries' ability to position forces or other threatening capabilities in our hemisphere. Past administrations perpetuated the belief that the Monroe Doctrine had expired. They were wrong. The Monroe Doctrine is in effect, and it is stronger than ever under the Trump corollary, a common sense restoration of our power and prerogatives in this hemisphere, consistent with U.S. interests."
That was Defense Secretary Hegseth. I wanted to ask you, though, Greg, Latin America is not the same region that it was 100 years ago or that it was 50 years ago. And when you mentioned this split in the region, I'm not so sure I agree with you on that. Brazil, Mexico, and Colombia are the three largest nations in Latin America. They have half the population of the entire region. And all three of those countries are being led still by progressive, left-wing-oriented presidents. None of them are going to back a U.S. Invasion, not to mention some of the smaller countries like Cuba or Nicaragua. And so we're in a situation where The United States is trying to impose a past that no longer exists. I'm wondering what you think, even if the intervention were to occur, and it seems likely that's going to happen just in time to eclipse any news of the release of the Epstein files, the ability of the United States to impose its chosen leader on Venezuela is going to be severely restricted, not only by the international condemnation, but also by the fact that the Venezuelan military has been politicized directly over years now as a result of the Chavez revolution. So they're not likely just to lay down their arms and allow the U.S. to come in.
Yeah, I agree with you completely, and that's what I meant, that the region was split, and that in Mexico and Brazil, if they're not isolated, then there is no kind of broader U.S. hegemony over the region, and certainly Colombia also, although there's elections coming up in Colombia, and that country is going to be in play, but I think Mexico and Brazil are secure for now, but. Yes, and speaking about Venezuela, it's unclear what the actual action is going to be. I mean, it's just stopping. Just the sanction and blockade on the oil tankers are going to put enormous pressure on Venezuela to, you know, in terms of food, in terms of being able to import food and feed its people, and what kind of disaster that's going to be. The sanctions are already incredibly punishing. There was bipartisan consensus going back decades to even Obama. We might see some massive show of force, some targeted strikes, but you're absolutely right. Venezuela is not Libya. It's not going to collapse. I think there is a kind of embedded structure that on the one hand there is a radicalized sector of the population. On the other hand, there are people invested in a kind of militarized corruption that does structure some of the ways the country is governed. And Maduro could or could not go, but that doesn't necessarily mean the United States is going to have its way and just be able to install a puppet like it did in Chile in 73 or Guatemala in 54 or any number of coups in the past. It's a dangerous game. I was sitting out in the waiting room today and just now, a second ago, and CNN talked about a second-year crash between a private jet and some U.S. military force. I mean, they're really pushing it to the max. You know, of course, these murders and on the high seas. Now we have an admission from the administration that this is just, you know, this has nothing to do with drugs. It has everything to do with Maduro. You know, these are innocent people. It's, you know, it's like he's like the Red Queen in Alice. You know, you execute, then you have the trial, and then you have the conviction, and then you have the trial. You know, he does everything backwards. We're living in like an Alice in Wonderland foreign policy in Latin America. But Latin America is confused. You know, there's tension within Latin America. Petro said that he wouldn't shake President-elect Castro's hand. This is a Nazi, and he was immediately rebuked by Boris, a center-leftist. So there's also a lot of tension within Latin America about how to respond to the United States. That kind of unity that existed coming out of the 2000s, Chavez, when Chavez was president and Lula was the president in Brazil, and you had Kirchner in Argentina, and you had Bachelet in Chile, and, you know, it was a very rhetorically strong and dominant form of social democracy that really commanded the rhetorical field. I think what we're seeing here is a lot of confusion about how to deal with Trump, just like the rest of the world. It is in some ways the madman doctrine of diplomacy, except the madman doctrine was supposed to be a performance, an act. But we actually have a madman in the White House in some ways.
Well, but this whole issue is... Clearly, the key aspect of this in Venezuela that distinguishes Venezuela from all the other governments that in the region that that Trump may not like is these vast oil reserves. Yeah. That on the one hand, could you talk about the importance of these oil reserves and also the fact that the American people, by and large, all the polls indicate they have no interest in the United States launching a war against Venezuela because Venezuela has not posed any threat to the United States.
Yeah, and that's interesting. And it's so I think that's one of the reasons why it's taking Trump so long to know to figure out what to do. He may be a madman, but he's not completely irrational. He does calculate, and there is obviously no bloodthirst within the rank and file of the Trump administration for a ground war in Venezuela, and certainly not within the country as a whole. And so he's responding to that. Then there's the calculus of, well, distraction, the Epstein files. Will this distract, or will people make the connection that we're doing it to distract? And, you know, there's a lot of independent